The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello. After last week's global travels, we're going to devote ourselves this week to the British Isles. But that doesn't mean that we've been slouching around the studio or indeed confining ourselves to the Queen's English. In fact, we're going to be singing the praises of this famous poet.
My love is like a red, red rose. It's newly sprung in June. My heart is like a melody that sweetly plays its tune. As fair art thou, my bonnie lad, so deep in love am I, and I will love thee still, my dear, till all the seas gang dry.
I hardly need tell you that was Scotland's most famous son, Rabbi Burns. Next, we'll be moving on to a book originally written in German, but about a very English place, Suffolk.
And I get the feeling that we're probably only a few years away from the blue plaques going up along the route. Somebody on a film actually says, the strange thing is that he is now part of this landscape in a way that the people he's writing about in here are part of this landscape. So the next Sebald has to take on board Sebald. Yeah. As one of the characters of this landscape.
And with me here in the studio is Sarah Crown from our book's website. Sarah, what exactly does landscape mean in a Sebaldian sense?
That's an interesting question, because in a Sebaldian sense it means something very different from what it means in any other sense. When he's writing about the landscape, he's writing about the geography, the place itself, but also the history. And he doesn't just mean the history of that landscape. He brings in history from around Europe. It's as if he's a sort of part of the landscape, as was sort of suggested in that clip himself. And he's bringing all of himself into the landscape and mixing it all up together. And it's that richness, that plurality that I think is the reason why so many people become completely obsessed with him.
Are you surprised that there's going to be a film about him?
It wouldn't have been the first book that I'd have picked to turn into a film. It's one of those books that when you read it, it feels completely cerebral, very much something that you're experiencing on your own, in your head, a voice that's speaking directly to you. So I'll be fascinated to see what the film's like. I mean, it sounds from the interview that it's going to be really interesting.
But we'll hang on there and find out what the director has to say a bit later on in the programme. Now, it might surprise you to learn that up till now, there hasn't been a proper museum devoted to Scotland's ploughman poet, Robert Burns. He's celebrated around the world every year on the 25th of January, and not just by the Scots, but by Americans, Japanese, and even some Chinese. For years, there's been a fascination with all the artefacts pertaining to his life, but they've all been held separately in both private and public collections. But that's all coming to an end, as this very evening, the new Burns Museum is opened in Scotland. Our correspondent, Severin Carell, has been to visit.
So I'm at the Robert Burns Birthplace Museum in Alloway in Ayr, very close to the cottage where Burns was born in 1759. It's being formally opened today by the celebrated Scottish poet Liz Lockhead alongside the Glasgow-based writer Alistair Gray. And I'm with Nat Edwards, the director of the museum.
Yes, this is the entrance to the museum. And the museum's a very, very serious museum in many ways, in that it contains the world's most important collection of Robert Burns, of manuscripts, artefacts, art relating to the life and work of Burns. But it's also a place where we really want people to get engaged with Burns and creatively engaged with Burns. So we open up the museum display with something of a surprise. On one hand, you see this very beautiful classical bust by the Queen's sculptor, John Steele, a copy of the same statue which sits in Westminster Abbey, and next to it, very importantly, to set the tone for the whole exhibition, is this quote from Hugh McDermott, who famously said in his poem, A Drunk Man Looks at the Thistle, "Mere nonsense has been uttered in his name than in honours barring liberty and Christ." And immediately, I think what we're trying to tell people is to put aside perhaps what they think they know about Burns, what they've been told about Burns, what they expect about Burns, and have a look at the evidence for who Burns was and why his work is so enduring and so important.
So as we walk through, we pass by one of his original writing desks. But then we turn the corner into the main body of the museum, and actually you've got a whole series of different display cases, but there's a lot of audiovisual material as well. It's quite an intense space that you really do need to spend a lot of time walking around and engaging with, don't you?
One of the most important things about Burns is, perhaps more than any other poet in writing in the English and Scots tradition, is he's enjoyed socially. Most people's encounters with Burns start at a Burns supper or at a Burns recital at school or at a concert when they're listening to one of Burns' songs. You know, he produced hundreds and hundreds of songs which have become the canon of Scottish traditional music. He's more of a performance poet than perhaps any of the other established poets in our canon, and we wanted him to be performed and experienced in performance, and we've commissioned a lot of new interpretations of Burns within the exhibit, but we've also put a lot of original material, a lot of original manuscripts, and encouraged people to get back to the root of what Burns is all about.
When Chapman bellies leave the street, and drithy neighbours meet, as market days are wearing late and folk begin to tack the gate, while we sit boozing at the nappy and getting foo and unca happy, we think now on the lang Scots miles, the mosses, waters, slaps and stiles that lie between us and our hame, where sits our sulky, sullen dame, gathering her brows like gathering storm, nursing her wrath to keep it warm. This truth fanned honest Tam O'Shanter, as he frae air ae night did canter, all there, wham ne'er a tune surpasses for honest men and bonny lasses. Ah, Tam, hadst thou been sae wise as ta'en thy ain wife Kate's advice, she told thee weel there was a skellum, a blether and bluster and drunken blellum, that frae November till October, ae market day, thou wasna sober. She prophesied that late or soon thou would be found deep drowned in doon, or catch wi warlocks in the murk, by Alloway's old haunted kirk. Ah, gentle dames, it gars me greet to think how many counsels sweet, how many lengthened sage advices the husband frae the wife despises.
But when you walk into the exhibition and into between the different display cases, you actually start with what was a birthing stool and also the nursing chair that his mother used for him as well. So you start very much with the day that Burns was born, don't you?
Well, of course, we are in the birthplace of Robert Burns, and Alloway was his childhood home. It was where this amazing imagination first started to form, and where he was exposed to all of the different relationships and all of the different influences which would then go on to shape his outlook on the world, his politics, his religion, his love of music, his love of the Scots language. So we start here, for example, in a section which looks at the identity of Burns. We try and cut him up into the various parts that made this very Scottish man of Peart's, and have a look through his relationships with different people, starting with his parents, what kind of man he was.
Yeah.
But as you say, getting back to the evidence, the original objects that we have. So here you have his father's armchair. You can imagine his father sitting, waiting for him to get back from the local dancing lessons that he used to sneak away to without his father's consent, waiting to get a lecture when he got back. There's his mother's nursing chair there. You can imagine the infant Burns first hearing the Scottish songs that his mother sang to him when he was an infant, and you can imagine that starting to form this love of Scots music.
And hriel y wains nach chilw tylie.
One artifact there as well, but I had to say my eye was struck to, since I was educated at in Edinburgh Primary School, was the tors as well. So there's a belt there on the wall used for punishing miscreant children. We don't think that she used it very often on him.
So it's reported in his brother's memoirs that the mother was very good-natured, and although she had a wee bit of a temper, she didn't use the tools very often. But I think, unfortunately, in Scottish education, up to, as you know, quite recently, the good old Loch Kelly was a fairly constant part of education.
There is also quite a deliberate emphasis here on its influences, what made Burns Burns. Can you just talk to me about a couple of the main cases that you have here?
Well, I think this is a very interesting case. If we go over to this case, which looks at the whole issue of nature and the natural world, and obviously Burns is very, very famous as a poet who observed and lived within and emerged from the natural world. He's a poet of the countryside. And of course, he wrote famously about a mouse, about a mountain daisy, about the countryside, the banks of Braes, the dune, the little birds, and so on. And I think people have a fairly romantic idea of Burns's writing in nature. But beneath that is some very, very deeply felt philosophies and politics, and a very deeply modern writer. And I think that's illustrated, for example, here we have one of his journals. He was a great journalist, and we have a number of his notebooks and journals in the collection. But even to me, more interestingly, is this little travelling pen set, which is the only surviving pen set that exists, and it's the one that he used as he travelled around the countryside writing. And we have all sorts of objects in the collection where he's written poems on the back of a banknote, where he's scratched poetry into a glass window, where we have manuscripts originally inscribed in charcoal above a fireplace. And here you see a poet who was observing and writing and recording within his natural environment, much in the way that a few years later, you know, the Impressionist painters were painting within the environment. This is a modern artistic method, very different, for example, to Wordsworth, who described poetry as the tranquil recollection of passion. This was passion in the field.
We sleekit cower in timorous beastie. Oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou needna start a war so hasty with bicker and brattle. I would be loath to run and chase thee with murder and paddle. I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union, and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal.
In the centre of the room, of course, there is the long case that's got the whole series of publications that are at the core of Burns's story, of course.
This is an amazing case, really, because in one simple display it tells you a lot about the story of this young man who became such a global phenomenon. Here, for example, we can see the proposal that he drew up to get his first book of poems published by subscription at the local printing press in Kilmarnock, which had only been around for about 4 years. Now, at this time in Burns's life, he had all sorts of problems. He had a failed relationship with Jean Armour. He was being pursued actively by Jean Armour's father with the threat of imprisonment. I mean, this was, you know, he was on the run from the law when he made a decision to emigrate to the West Indies and take up a job on a plantation there. And he needed some cash. And really quickly, within a couple of years, he had gone from an unknown Ayrshire ploughman to somebody fated in the literary reviews of London and Edinburgh, in the salons in Edinburgh, a global superstar. And it's interesting, here you can see the wonderful silver-trimmed punch bowl. And this is a Victorian copy of the one that now sits in the British Museum, that was presented by Jean Armour's father to the now very successful Burns when he
Suddenly they've made up, have they?
Yes, yes. And you can see the effect that celebrity had on Armour's approach to Burns. Burns, more than any other writer, became elevated to the position of an icon. In a country, a Calvinist country in Scotland, which doesn't have a lot of saints and a lot of icons, Burns filled that vacuum. And we can see in the displays all sorts of examples of how just months and years after his death, he became elevated from this, as you say, humble person who couldn't even vote, to something of a saint. We have an amazing marble relief showing the birth of Burns as a religious nativity. It wouldn't be out of place in a Florentine church. Burns transcended the writer, he transcended poetry and became this strange iconic figure. And the whole tradition of the Burns Supper happened very, very quickly. The first Burns Supper was held here 5 years after his...
Because you have, I understand, 5,000 separate Burns artefacts in the museum and in the manuscript store upstairs. And that in itself tells a story about how quickly people recognise Burns to be a crucially important literary and cultural figure that everybody was actually preserving. So many, at the time, must have been fairly mundane pieces of furniture, equipment, and then suddenly all the deification takes place. It's quite remarkable, isn't it, how quickly his fame developed.
Absolutely. I mean, the only thing that really equates to it, I think, in modern terms, is the kind of celebrity culture you get around people like the Beatles and Elvis. And it's very much of that scale.
We're standing now in front of a display case that's dedicated to one of his most famous poems, Tam O'Shanter, the story of the drunk escaping the devil over the Brig of Doon, just around the corner from the museum.
The wonderful thing, for example, about Tam O'Shanter is that it's not just a great work of the imagination, but it's set very much in a real landscape with real people in it. So here we have a handguard belonging to the character Suter Johnny in the poem. We have the original manuscript there. You can sit down and listen to the poem recited in full. You can read a transcript. You can play with a digital game, a sort of digital Letraset action transfer game where you can make your own Tam O'Shanter story. And of course, wonderfully, something you can't do in any other museum is you can go out of the museum, cross the road, and find yourself right in the middle of the haunted kirkyard where the poem is set. Yep. And then go and visit Burns Cottage, where the young Burns heard the ghost stories that he was later to weave into the poem. So you can become any of the characters.
So Maggie runs, the witches follow, with money and eldritch screech and hollow. Oh, Tam, they'll get thy fairin, and hell they'll roast thee like a heron. In vain thy Kate awaits thy coming, Kate soon will be a woeful woman. Now do thy speedy utmost, Meg, and win the keystone o' the brig. There at them thou thy tail may toss, a running stream that erna cross, but ere the keystone she could make, the faint a tail she had to shake. For Nanny, far before the rest, hard upon noble Maggie pressed, and flew at Tam with furious ettle, but little wished she Maggie's mettle. Aye spring brought off her master hale, but left behind her ain grey tail. The carlin clotter by the rump, and left poor Maggie scarce a stump. Now, wha this tale of truth shall read, elk man and mother's son, take heed. Whene'er to drink ye are inclined, or cutty sarks run in your mind, think ye may buy the joys o'er dear. Remember, Tam O'Shanter's near.
So, as Severin said, Liz Lockhead is opening the Burns Museum this evening, but we've beaten them to her. We've got her on the phone right now. Hi, Liz.
Hello, dear.
Hi. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Now, we've been at the Museum for Scotland's first national poet, and you've just become the latest to hold the title. Tell us what the title is. I can't pronounce it.
Oh, it's perfectly easy. Maka.
Maka. And what does it mean?
It means maker. It's as simple as that. It's used in a specialised sense by the poet Dunbar about other poets. It's used to mean shapers and makers of words and emphasises the craftsmanship element in it. But he mentions as Macars Chaucer and various other English poets as well. Okay, it's not a word that we use in an everyday sense anymore, but one of the things that I think we can really do with poetry is revivify language, and it's not difficult to learn a word like maca. It just means maker.
Now, Liz, we go back a long way because I remember the days of Mary Queen of Scots got her head chopped off at the Edinburgh Fringe and all that sort of excitement.
Well, that's a while ago now, but it was a terrific time for me because I was working with probably Scotland's greatest, very poor theatre company, but just pure inventiveness of working with Comunicado at that time was a wonderful experience. It was all by the seat of our pants, but we got there, and it was definitely my best known play.
Yes. Now, Sarah, who's in the studio with me, is younger, and she's got some questions to ask you because she missed out on that.
Well, she didn't have to. I mean, it's been done since, but not often enough. The National Theatre of Scotland revived it, but in a very little production that went on the road 2 years ago, just to some small, small venues in the Highlands, which was a great pity because it would be great to get a decent new production of it on the go with some decent space. It would be terrific.
Hi, Liz. Well, actually, this sort of ties into the first question that I wanted to ask you about Robert Burns, which was about his significance as a performance poet, which Severin mentioned. As a playwright, presumably this is an issue that's quite close to your heart, the idea of poetry and performance.
Well, yes, I came out of that tradition, which was very much happening again in the 1960s. But now it tends to be a narrower range of things. It now means more like rap and kind of poetry slams. In the 60s, 70s and 80s, there was a lot more poetry of all kinds being performed out loud. There was a real efflorescence, I would say, of poetry festivals. And people like hearing poems out loud, quite justifiably, because it is an oral and an oral art.
And that's, again, that sort of brings us back to Burns a bit, because is it true or fair to say that he was the first poet who really wrote in the Scots dialect, and that's part of the reason for his enduring appeal?
Well, he wasn't the first, but he was the greatest. I mean, he was coming, there's a tradition of two or three very good poets, Ferguson being one of them, poor mad Ferguson. And but he was the greatest of a tradition, and he started, arguably, he started another tradition. There's a real argument for thinking of him as the first of the Romantics. Wordsworth was an enormous fan of Burns and Keats, and, you know...
This is through his marrying of nature and politics, then? Is that what you're referring to?
That, among other things, but he's definitely his love of nature and the sociableness of his writing, I think.
Mm.
You know, the kind of poets he read were all people that we don't read so much now, like Gray and Shenstone, but the people that he influenced were... You know, Wordsworth, Keats, Byron, he, another poet of great personality, different bank book, but with many of the same attributes as Burns. Byron's Scottishness, I think, did come via Burns, and he was an enormous admirer of Burns as well.
And as Claire said, you are now Scotland's national poet, taking over from Robbie Burns, or certainly in a long line of descendants.
No, taking
maybe a little from strong.
The late, great Edwin Morgan, who was the first of this, the Scottish Macar.
And would you say that Burns has been an influence on you?
Of course. You can't be a writer, really, in Scotland without being influenced by Burns one way or the other. It might be a reaction against him. Not in my case. I grew up being taught to say Burns out loud. When I'm opening the museum, I'm going to be saying, without opening the book, I hope, To a Mouse, which I first learned when I was 10 years old. And Burns was writing down a voice, many different voices, but, you know, in each individual poem, he was writing down the voice of that poem. And really, to be enjoyed and appreciated, you've got to hear Burns out loud, even if you're reading him in black and white. And that's the way to understand him, is to say it out loud. Mm-hmm. Not to assume that the I in any Burns poem is him, or the whole hymn. Don Patterson, the great Scottish poet, says very accurately of Burns that the song that he sang was Man is Various. You know, he was very many different kinds of people, all of them quite sincere and a lot of them contradictory.
Now, the curator of the museum there emphasised the importance of the museum being on the site of Burns' own home, didn't he? Do you think that's really important, that we have a sense of where he actually lived and wrote and thought?
It's not the most important thing to me. I mean, the most important thing to me is that people get a sense of that place via Burns' words. But it'll certainly be nice to be down there. It's not far away. It's down by the sea. There's a lot of things that refer to the cult of Burns as well as Burns himself, and that's deeply, deeply interesting, mm-hmm. but not to me as interesting as reading Burns' poetry.
Now, Liz, I have to now ask you, would you read, for the benefit of Guardian podcast listeners, To a Mouse for us?
To a Mouse?
Would you say it, recite it now?
Yes, okay. Okay, well, I'm not looking at the book. You'll have to take me on trust. And I did learn this to say out loud at the Miners' Welfare in Newark Hill, Lanarkshire, as part of a competition where a lot of us said this poem, and, you know, various other poems of Burns were said, and lots of his songs were sung. He was a great collector of songs as well. But here's To a Mouse. On turning her up in her nest with the plough, November 1785. I read that bit, now I'm just saying it. Wee sleekit, cooing, timorous beastie. Oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou needna start a wassie hasty wi' bicker and brattle. I would be laith to rin and chase thee wi' murder and pattle. I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy pair earth-born companion and fellow mortal. I doubt na whiles but thou may thieve. What then? Poor beastie, thou mun live. A dame nicker and a thrave's a small request. I'll get a blessing with a lave and never miss it. Thou wee bit hoosie too in ruin. It's silly was the winds are strewing and naething new to big a new in o' foggage green and bleak December's winds ensuing, both snell and keen. Thou saw the fields laid bare and wast, and weary winter coming fast, and cosy here beneath the blast thou thought to dwell, till crash the cruel coulter passed out through thy cell. That wee bit heap o' leaves and stibble has cost thee money a weary nibble, now thou's turned out for all thy trouble, but house or hold, to thaw the winter's sleety dribble and cranrach called. But, Mousie, thou art no thy lane, and proven foresight may be vain. The best laid schemes o' mice and men gang after glee, and Leah's nocht but grief and pain for promised joy. Still, thou art blessed compared with me. The present only toucheth thee, but, och, I backward cast my ee on prospects drear, and forward, though I canna see, I guess and fear.
Oh, how fantastic. Macca to Macca. You... Liz, thank you very much for coming on the programme, and I have a fantastic Burns night.
Thank you very much indeed.
Till all the seas gang dry, my dear, the rocks melt with the sun, and I shall love.
Well, of course, it was in a field that that poor wee mouse was cowering. So let's stay with the idea of place, and it's, of course, a concept particularly important to the author W.G. Sebald. One of his most famous books is The Rings of Saturn, based on a walk he made along the Suffolk coast. It's now being made into a film called Patience, brackets, After Sebald, and it'll be given its first showing at Aldborough's Snake Maltings on Friday next week. That's the 28th. Stuart Jeffries went to Suffolk to meet its director, Grant Gee.
In August 1992, the German writer W.G. Sebald set off to walk the county of Suffolk. He hoped that the walk from his home in Norwich along the coast and through the countryside would give him a sense of freedom after a long and miserable period writing a book in his study. The result of that walk was his greatest book, The Rings of Saturn. It traces his melancholy tour of literary graveyards. It also takes him off in strange meandering riffs into such horrors as the Holocaust, slavery, mass deaths in sea battles off the Suffolk coast. Before Sebald died 10 years ago in a car crash, he was being touted as a future Nobel Prize laureate. Today, among those commemorating the 10th anniversary of his death, is Grant Gee, who has made a film retracing Sebald's steps for the Rings of Saturn.
So, Grant, we're sitting in the Crown Hotel in the very bar where W.G. Sebald started reading The Independent on Sunday, one fateful day, and he writes...
Surely The Guardian.
But he writes, "For some time I had been feeling a sense of eternal peace when, leafing through The Independent on Sunday, I came across an article." And that article, well, perhaps you could talk about it, is, it suddenly takes him out of this world of eternal peace, doesn't it?
It does. I always thought it was over there, that little table in the window over there.
Yeah.
Reading the Sunday papers in a lovely little hotel in a lovely little seaside town, and comes across a grainy photograph of people hanged from the felled branch of a very large tree. And he says that this happened at the Jasenovic camp. Serbs, Jews and Bosnians once rounded up, they were hanged in rows like crows or magpies. by the Croatian militia, its hand strengthened by the Wehrmacht, and its spirit by the Catholic Church. They perform one day's work after another in similar matter. The history of this massacre, which went on for years, is recorded in 50,000 documents abandoned by the Germans and Croats in 1945. So suddenly he's into this little forgotten corner of the Holocaust while sitting in a lovely little bar, in a lovely little hotel, in a lovely little seaside town. He was reminded that there was a young clerk in the SS at that time who was administering this kind of business, and that young clerk later became very competent in the technicalities of administration and occupied various high offices, among them that of Secretary General of the United Nations. And reportedly, it was in this last capacity that he spoke onto tape for the benefit of any extraterrestrials that may happen to share our universe, words of greeting that are now, together with other memorabilia of mankind, approaching the outer limits of our solar system aboard the space probe Voyager 2. Because that was Kurt Waldheim.
And for your film, you've actually got a recording of Waldheim's voice, the one that's now being beamed to extraterrestrials in space.
Yes.
How do you put it? This seemingly unfilmable book, how do you make a film about it?
Well, the reason why, of all Sebald's work, I chose this book to focus on was because it has at its core a very obviously and easily filmable thing, which is a walk around Suffolk. I wanted to make it partly biographical about Sebald, partly literary, an exploration of what this book was, and partly a kind of representation of some of the ideas in the book. You can get people to talk about Sebald, you can get people to talk about their love and deep relationship with this book. The same sources are feeding into this book that you yourself can get hold of, whether it's the German film about Nazi silkworm breeding, the BBC documentary about Roger Casement, which you watched in the room upstairs, well, he fell asleep watching in the room upstairs here, you know, the NASA film or the NASA recording of Kurt Waldheim reading.
We're now also sitting in a place which is almost now the epicentre of a Sebaldian tourist industry in a way, because people come here and do the Rings of Saturn walk, and you know, you were just saying there's a pub down in Dunwich where, you know, there was a review of it and they said, you know, don't forget to bring your Rings of Saturn for the perfect weekend.
Sure.
So, you know, everything's got a bit wrong, and Sebald would have hated a lot of this.
Quite, yeah, I'm sure he would have. This film that I'm doing is another nail in the... I mean, pilgrims. People quite often use the word pilgrims. And in fact, when the book was written in German, it was subtitled An English Pilgrimage, and he felt, I think, that he was on some kind of strange pilgrimage without a chalice at the end of it. I mean, the walk that he did was in 1992. This book was published in German in 1995. Published in Britain in 1998, he was dead in 2001, and it's in the years since his death that the kind of cult, the strange cult of this book has grown and grown and grown. It started off with several other writers and artists kind of making work based, spun out of the concerns or the imagery of the Rings of Saturn, and I get the feeling that we're probably only a few years away from the blue plaques going up along the route. Somebody on a film actually says the strange thing is that he is now part of this landscape in a way that the people he's writing about in here are part of this landscape. So the next Sebald has to take on board Sebald as one of the characters of this landscape. If you look at what he actually did, you know, rather than what his narrator did, his narrator is in this landscape.
Yeah.
You know, this is what it is. No birds singing, no nothing. Whereas if you think about why Max Sebald would have done this walk, he would have started at Summer Leighton Hall because he was interested in faded empire.
Interested.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
faded
wealth. What happens when the wealth goes away? Yep. Very interesting. Then he walked down the lowest office, it was the nearest place where there was a hotel to stay. Yep,
right.
Fair enough. Then he walked down this beautiful bit of coastline, you know, absolutely astonishing bit of coastline. Lovely. Stayed in Southwold at that nice hotel where we were for, three or four days probably, based on, you know, where he went from there. Then he went down to Dunwich, very interesting, you know, history there. Then he walked inland to see his friend, the poet, you know, spent the day with him, very nice. Got a ride back, spent another night in Southwold, fell asleep watching the telly.
What's not to like?
And then sort of walked inland to some interesting churches which had a bit of a literary pedigree.
Yeah.
And then his wife took him home. You know, that's
decent holiday.
Yeah. When he's writing this, he must have, as he walked, unless it was all premeditated, have been getting turned on by the thoughts of some of the things he's uncovering, you know. That it must have been a great excitement to him. It's a turn-on to do this walk, in a way, isn't it?
The lost subtitle in English is An English Pilgrimage.
Yeah.
So the pilgrimage bit of it is visiting the sites of literary graveyards. Mm. Yeah. And strangely, you know, this is what's happening now with him. This landscape has become a kind of a literary pilgrimage route.
Stuart Jeffries there on the shingle with Grant Gee. We'll be putting a film of their walk up on the Guardian website next week, so look out for it. And that's all from us this week. Sarah, tell us what we've got coming up.
Well, in Saturday's Guardian Review, we have Mark Lawson looking at the latest novelisation of a politician's life. In this case, it's Barack Obama, and it's set in the future. It's out next week in the US, but it's already causing lots of excited speculation over here since it's written by our old friend Anonymous.
Oh, him.
Yes,
or
back
her.
Again. Yeah, well, quite so.
It's usually him, though, isn't it?
It does tend, I'd say, through history to be him.
And what about The Observer?
Oh, just one more thing about The Guardian, actually. We'll be running a competition on Saturday as well, asking you to send us your own fictional biographies of politicians, past, present or future. And for details, if you want to do that, see the front page of this podcast. And then on The Observer, in the new review on Sunday, we have an extract from a moving new memoir of living with an autoimmune disease, and that's by the American poet Sarah Manguza. And then on the Books website, if you want to go to that now, we have a wonderful video of the excellent Judith Kerr, author of The Tiger Who Came to Tea and the Mog Books, to mark the 40th anniversary of her autobiography, When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit.
Yeah, we've got a bit of a competition going on the Guardian Books there, haven't we, of who's going to adopt her as a granny.
Yes.
I don't qualify, I'm too old, I'll just have to adopt the cat, I think. Anyway, join us next week for some thoughts about life and death with the philosopher John Gray and the scientist Philip Ball. Until then, have a very happy Burns Night from me, Sarah, and our producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.